Good morning. Very happy to be standing here. It is a true honor. You have no idea what it means to be able to share God's word with you. So it's been a great journey getting ready for this, and I'm excited about what we have to talk about today. Just a few weeks ago on August 13th, Leslie and I celebrated 30 years in our little house in Mesquite. Some of you in this room actually helped move us into that house all those years ago. The house was horrible. It was a train wreck. I'm sure it was charming when it was built in the 50s, but something went awry. Some bad owners. It was abandoned when we got it. It had deteriorated almost to the point of being condemned. The garage door was completely off the hinges. Massive hole in the bathroom floor looking right down to the dirt. Peeling paint, rotted wood. It was awful. The landscaping was no better. The lawn amounted to Dallas grass, about 3 feet tall, trash, stumps, and chiggers. One neighbor came across the street. She said, "You won't last 1 year in this house." Well, I took that as a personal challenge, and I showed her. Right off the bat, being the tree lover that I am, I figured one of my very first jobs is to get the right trees planted in the right spots. So I knew it would take years for me to fix this old house up, but I wanted to get the trees in the ground so they could be growing as I worked on the thing. So I spared no expense. I bought 4 trees for $10 each. At Home Depot on sale, I bought 2 pecans, a bur oak, and a red oak. They looked more like pencils than trees. They're about 3 feet tall. Literally, when fall came, there were no limbs. I thought there were limbs. They were just leaves, and they all dropped off. I told Leslie when I plant them, "I can see it in my mind. One day these things will be massive and the shade will cover our house." I said there'll be a tunnel over our driveway. We'll drive through the shade. Those 4 dinky little trees were my promise to my family of a gorgeous landscaping in the distant future. And it worked. 30 years later, I live in a forest. I believe when I rake leaves in the fall, I have more leaves per square inch to clean up than any other person in Mesquite. All right, there's a parallel between that story and the story of the Bible. Like my house when it was first built, God created a pristine world, and then he entrusted that world to some caretakers, Adam and Eve. Something went terribly wrong. They sinned. And God responded by pronouncing a curse. And that once beautiful world was reduced to sweat and toil and tears and thistles and thorns and, I'm guessing, chiggers as well. Like my house when I moved in. And it was into that damaged and deteriorating world that God made a promise. Like planting a small tree. And that tree, it wasn't an oak or a pecan. That tree was a lone, solitary individual named Abraham. God promised that Abraham would become a great nation. Abraham would inherit a great land. And through Abraham, the whole world would be blessed, all the people. Contained within that specific promise to Abraham and the nation of Israel are the seeds of the ultimate promise of God. All things renewed under Christ. Beyond the rapture of the church, beyond the tribulation, beyond the millennium, to the very culmination of God's plan. The Bible calls that the new heaven and the new earth. In that day, what was lost in the garden will be restored. Paradise lost will become paradise regained. In my favorite verses of the Bible, we read about the new heaven and the new earth. In Revelation 21, I read, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, no more mourning, no more crying, no more pain, for the old order of things has passed away.' He who was seated on the throne said, 'I'm making all things new.'" That is the final destiny for all God's people, from Adam to Abraham to you and me and beyond. Like a massive oak tree spreading its limbs, the glory of God will fill the entire world. Imagine that day. Our upside down world turned right side up. we will have righteous hearts. Imagine a day without an impure thought, without selfishness. We will have incorruptible bodies and minds. My in-laws visited just a week ago, and my father-in-law got out of the car. It's like, what happened to you? You're 2 inches shorter. He's just shrinking. No more of that. No more growing old. No more Alzheimer's. No more autism. No mental illness. We will live in a pristine world with mountains and valleys and streams and wildflowers and animals and clean air and blue skies, just like it was in Eden. And we will enjoy satisfying relationships without conflict. We won't have to walk on eggshells. It'll be satisfying. In a nutshell, it will be heaven on earth. We will be, in every sense of the word, home at last. That is our destiny. That is the culmination of human history. That is what you and I can expect for our future. Which brings me to our question today. What can we expect while we wait for that future? We are now living somewhere between the promise made and the promise of God fulfilled. What can we count on in this in-between time? What can we expect while we wait? And that question is relevant because it is answered in a variety of ways today. If you were to go home and turn on your TV this afternoon, you might hear a preacher say something like, in the in-between time, life can go smoothly if we have enough faith. The blessings of that future, heaven and new heaven, new earth, can be ours to claim here and now. With enough faith, we can enjoy comfortable, smooth, healthy lives. That's what some people say that we can expect in this in-between time. Here's another somewhat optimistic viewpoint. Others say that while we can't reverse the curse for the whole world, we can win the battle with sin in our own hearts and lives. I just read a book written by a man who held that perspective. He said that believers can be transformed here and now in practical terms from sinners to saints. Through the power of the Spirit, we can grow to the point of what he called entire sanctification. We can reach a point in our Christian journey where we no longer sin. And as a result, we can smooth out the road. We'll no longer incur the problems associated with our own foolish behavior. He says that's what we can expect in the meantime. Flip the coin over. There are others who see life here and now in a somewhat more pessimistic way. Some believe that in the interim period between the promise made and the promise fulfilled, the earth is depraved. Our hearts will remain depraved. And in the meantime, we're basically on our own to muddle through somehow. God will come through for his people in that final day. But in the day-to-day experience of our lives, God is somewhat deaf to the needs of his people. They would say, don't expect too much from God while we wait. Now, I'm not proud of this, but I have felt that way sometimes. I have wondered from time to time if God was truly attentive to the needs of his children. Does he really care? Does he listen to our prayers? Does he listen to my prayers? I put my doubts into words when I said to a dear friend not too long ago, I said, it seems the more I pray, the worse things get. I truly expect a grand finale. But in my weaker moments, I sometimes wonder if I can expect much from God along the way. All right, here's one last viewpoint. It's even more pessimistic than that one. Some feel that God's promise won't come true at all. They've lost faith in that future promise of God. Maybe based on the downhill trajectory of our world, and add to that, it's been thousands of years since he made the promise. It's just not going to happen. I've read some take the approach that the ultimate destiny for God's people is something along the lines of a ghost-like resurrection to an otherworldly experience. Paradise, like it was in the Garden of Eden, is lost forever. We will experience nothing like that in our future, so they say, don't live today with that false hope of heaven on earth. All right, those are just a few, just a handful of the varying answers to our questions. So what is it? What is it that you and I can realistically expect in the in-between time? What can we expect while we wait for that promise to be fulfilled? Our passage today helps to answer that question. Today we're going to be looking at a story about the birth of Isaac, and then Ishmael in this story is kicked out of the family of Abraham. In this story, I believe we get a glimpse as New Testament Christians what we can expect while we wait for the promise of God, the ultimate culmination of his plan. So if you want to follow along in your Bibles, you can open to Genesis chapter 21, beginning with verse 1, or you can follow along on the screen as I read. Genesis 21, beginning with verse 1. We're about to read a very emotional story. The people in this story, their emotions run the gamut from laughter to distress, from celebration to just sobbing. Follow along as I read Genesis 21, 1 through 21. Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the very time God had promised him. Abraham gave him the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him. When his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him as God commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. The child grew and was weaned, and on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. But Sarah saw that the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, had born to Abraham, was mocking. And she said to Abraham, get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. The matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son. But God said to him, do not be so distressed about the boy and your maidservant. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation, also because he is your offspring. Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of wine and gave them to Hagar. He sent them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. She went on her way and wandered in the desert of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went off and sat down nearby about a bow shot away, for she thought, I cannot watch the boy die. And as she sat there, she began to sob. God heard the boy crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what's the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies here. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy as he grew. He lived in the desert, became an archer. While he was living in the desert of Paran, his mother got a wife from him from Egypt. That story gives you and me a realistic snapshot of what we can expect while we wait for the promise of God to be fulfilled. In this story, we will see two realities that we can expect, two things we can count on. The first one's sobering. In some respects, you just call it flat out bad news. The second is encouraging. It's the good news. And together, they will give us a healthy viewpoint on life this side of the promise. Together, they show us what we can expect while we wait. So here we go. Here's the bad news first. What can we expect while we wait? We can expect a bumpy ride. We can expect a bumpy ride. It's going to be rough, just like Abraham, Sarah, Ishmael, Hagar, we too will experience the negative impact of sin. Life will not be smooth sailing. This side of Revelation 21 and 22, the curse remains, sin remains, and until Jesus returns, buckle up, it's going to be a bumpy ride. Now that may be uncomfortable for you to hear. But if you've been a believer for any time at all, you know it's true. I spoke to a guy many years ago. His name was Tom, and I was sharing the gospel with Tom. And he said to me, he asked me an interesting question. I've chewed on it for years since then. He said, "Steve, if I become a Christian, will my life get better?" Well, my knee-jerk reaction at the time was to say, well, of course it would get better. But then I hesitated. And it's like, well, it depends on what you mean by better. I mean, in some ways, it could actually get worse. Maybe your family won't be real happy about your conversion. Maybe the sin that you used to participate in and enjoy, you will battle from here on. It was a tough question to answer. I spoke to with a fellow just this week. He told me, he said, "Steve, I've shed more tears since I've been a believer than I ever did before." Christian life is not an easy life. It's a richer life. It's a more purposeful life. It's a more hopeful life, but not necessarily an easier life. Better? Yes. Easier? I don't think so. No matter how much we pray, no matter how many verses we memorize, no matter how much faith we pump up, not one of us will escape the negative impact of sin. Either our own sin, the sin of others, or just the very real hardships of living in a sin-cursed world. Until Jesus returns, life's going to be a bumpy ride, just as it was for the characters in our story. In that middle section that we read, those verses are heartbreaking. Every one of the participants are in pain. The only one unscathed is the baby Isaac. There's plenty of sin to go around and plenty of hardship and heartache to go around as well. Some of the characters are more guilty than others. Sarah and Ishmael, they're clearly in the wrong. Abraham, he's less guilty at first, but then we read on that he's messed up too. In the story, the only one that is presented as innocent is Hagar, and ironically, she's the one that suffers more than anybody. The whole thing's a mess. Everyone's hurting, whether they deserved it or not, which supports the point that this side of that promise, it's going to be a bumpy ride. So whether we're on the driving end or on the receiving end, sin will create in your life and my life problems that defy solutions. Problems that are so severe that it seems not even God can solve them, like the problem in our story. We read, "The child grew and was weaned, and on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast." Now, in our culture, we throw reveal parties now. We throw birthday parties, but in his culture, I guess they threw weaning parties. Okay. Starts out as a happy day. Baby Isaac, the son promised Abraham and Sarah, is now up and running on his own. He's passed from infancy to childhood. So he threw a big party, and in keeping with his wealth, it said he threw a feast, a great feast. My footnote says it included ribs, smoked meat, pecan pie, potato salad, a great feast. A good time was had by one and all until somebody showed up and crashed the party. It was a teenage boy, Abraham's son, his oldest son, Ishmael. And Ishmael was spouting off some very ugly things. We read in verse 9, "But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham was mocking." I can relate a tiny bit to a party going south like that one. My family was gathered on Christmas Day. My family, all our kids, my brother and his family, all his kids, having a grand old time. There's a knock at the door. One of my employees from my business. And he wanted to thank me for a Christmas gift. I invited him in. Turns out he is as drunk as a human being could be. He sat on my couch for 20 minutes, sobbing and spouting nothing but nonsense. Until I got him out of the house and on his way, our party kind of took a negative turn. All right, well, that's what we have here. Ishmael is mocking and the party has been derailed. Well, obviously, there's a bit of a backstory to what we just read. We need a little insight as to what's going on. This just didn't happen out of the blue. So we go back 25 years to when God promised to Abraham and Sarah a child through whom he would multiply Abraham's descendants into a great nation. 10 years go by. They're both getting older and older, and their confidence that God could do this was waning. So Sarah decided she's done waiting on God, and she took matters into her own hands. And in chapter 16, we read, she says, "Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Well, that idea had stupid written all over it. Yet Abraham cooperated, and Abraham took Sarah, we read, as his wife, and we read that he slept with Hagar, and she conceived. Sarah got her wish. We would think that Sarah would be happy, but she wasn't. Hagar was proud of the fact that she was pregnant, and Sarah wasn't. So Sarah turned rabid on her husband Abraham and said, "It's all your fault." And then Sarah goes on, it says, to severely mistreat Hagar, and Abraham said, "Do with her what you want," and he looks the other way. A side lesson, one woman per household, plenty. Just note. All right, fast forward 17 years to our story today. The family feud continues. Old sins rear their ugly heads once again. And in this scene, it's Ishmael himself who goes on the offensive. He mocks his little brother in front of Sarah. That, too, was not a good idea. Now, we don't know what he said, but I suspect it had to do with him being the heir of Abraham's inheritance, not that little boy. Well, her fuse burned down to the dry powder, and she exploded with awful words. She said to Abraham in verse 10, "Get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son, Isaac." She threw down the gauntlet. "Abraham, either they go or we go. You choose." Once again, Abraham's caught in the middle. This is a no-win situation. This is an untenable dilemma, and Abraham feels it deeply. It says the matter distressed Abraham, not a little bit. It says it distressed him greatly because it concerned his son. Have you ever found yourself in the middle between two people that you love, knowing that whichever choice you make, somebody's going to be hurt? I can relate. On the lighter side, much lighter side, I found myself between Leslie and our little dog Coco, a stubborn dachshund. Coco wouldn't listen to Leslie. She said, "Get in your chair." He'd kind of snarl. I'd say, "Get in your chair." Hop right up. Problem was, Coco spent most of his life with my wife while I was at work. One night I came home, and Coco had been a bad little doggy that day, and Leslie drew the line in the sand. She said, "Somebody's leaving. It's either me or him. You choose." So I said, "Let me chew on that for a bit. I'll get back to you." All right. I can also relate on a much more emotional level. I remember a time when there was tension in our household, and I was caught in the middle between Leslie and one of our daughters. Tensions had risen, and they were both dug in, and it was my role to somehow mediate. I needed to step in and work things out, but the problem was there was no solution. There was no good plan. You know what I did? It was all I could do. I sat at the table, Leslie on one side, daughter on the other. I held Leslie's hand. I said, "I love you." I held my daughter's hand and said, "I love you." I just sat there and wept. That's all I could do. There was no solution to that problem. And that's the way life is in this fallen world. There are problems we can't solve. There, as one man put it, there are storms we cannot weather. Abraham is in that situation. There are no good options. So God stepped in and gave him the direction. He said, "Listen to Sarah. Send Hagar away." Verse 14 is very difficult to read. Oh, my goodness. Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water, gave them to Hagar. He sent them on her shoulders, sent her off with the boy. She went on her way and wandered in the desert. Some of you dads have had trouble sending your kids off to college. I just spoke to one of you guys just last week. It's emotional. Dads aren't as tough as we make out. I remember when Kelly, our middle daughter, went to A&M, and we had her all situated, Les and I, and she was all set in her dorm. Everything's done. We're ready to drive away. But it's time for me to say goodbye. I was completely unable to form that one word, goodbye. I couldn't. I'd make a run at it, and then I'd just make another run at it. In broad daylight, I am sobbing like an infant, embarrassing my daughter. And I would see her at Thanksgiving, just a couple of months. Sending a child to college is tough on a dad, but imagine being in Abraham's shoes. Oh, my goodness. He's sending his son off to who knows what. And he wasn't going to see him at Thanksgiving. This is goodbye in the ultimate sense. This is truly goodbye, an end to the relationship. And it's horrible, horrible. Yet he had to do it. But that's life here and now while we wait for better days to come. What's troubling to me, puzzling to me, is the meager provisions that Abraham gave to Hagar and Ishmael. He was a wealthy man. He should have, could have, sent her with a donkey and a cart full of food and water and supplies to help them with their new life. But I suspect that Abraham had given in once again to his wife, and he sent them off with a little food and a knapsack, and it says a skin of water. It's inexcusable. Inexcusable. It's like sending someone across Death Valley with a quarter tank of gas. It's a death sentence. And no surprise, the provisions ran out and the ravages of thirst set in verse 15. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under the bushes. She said, I can't watch the boy die. She began to sob. It's ironic. The only person in this story not implicated in doing anything wrong in this case is Hagar, and she's the one who's suffering the most. It's a mess. Some are suffering in direct proportion to their sin. Others are suffering in a disproportionate level to their sin, and some are suffering through no fault of their own. That was life for this little group of people, and I suggest to one degree or another, that will be our experience as well. Life will be for all of us a bumpy ride. I think we have a mistaken tendency to think that life in large part is within our control. To that end, we devour self-help books, even Christian self-help books. How to build a good marriage, how to build a successful business, how to raise godly kids, how to handle conflict, how to ride a horse without falling off, things like that. These books, as helpful as they are, imply that if we do X, Y, and Z, we will reap the desired outcome. Even many of our sermons have that implication. But that's simply not the case. The truth is, doing what's right is no guarantee against misfortune. Three cheers for wise living. I'm on board with wise living, but the wisest people on earth are not able to insulate themselves from the impact of sin. You could take care of your cholesterol. You could get all the exercise you can handle. And you can still slip on a banana peel that somebody carelessly tossed on the ground. All life's ventures, from building a family to building a farm, come with inherent risks. Risks that we cannot eliminate, no matter how we live. True, we are often the direct cause of our misery because our sin bites back. But even if we were to somehow avoid personal sin, which we cannot, we will still find our lives in turmoil from time to time. We can, through our sin, make our lives infinitely worse than they need to be. That is true. But we cannot, through righteous living, make our lives smooth. We all know this to be true. Just look at the prayer requests in our own bulletin. That long list represents 0.01% of the needs in this room. Every one of us can testify to the irreparable harm of sin. Behind many of your smiles are tears ready to flow. You say, Steve, that sounds like a very depressing way to live. Very depressing outlook on life. Well, quite the contrary. No way. When we accept that sobering truth, we're less shocked by adversity. Okay, we can take it more in stride. We're less hard on ourselves. We say, where did I go wrong? If only I had. We're far less hard on other people. Where they went wrong. we appreciate far more the real-time blessings, great and small, that God sends our way that we have, like a cup of coffee or a sunrise or a conversation. And we live far more enthusiastic about that day to come. No, accepting the messy nature of life is not depressing. It's actually freeing. So, what can we expect while we wait for that promise to be fulfilled? Don't expect to reverse the curse, and don't expect to bring on the blessings of that day to come. That's Jesus' job when he returns. But until he does, expect a bumpy ride. That's the first reality we need to expect while we wait for the new heaven and the new earth. And here's the second. What else can we expect? We can also expect this. We can expect God to remain faithful to his people and to his promise. No matter how messy our lives get, even if we are the cause, God never abandons us. Rather, God will remain consistently, doggedly attentive and committed to his children. Expect God to remain faithful to his people and to his promise. In this story, we see God's faithfulness shown to every one of these people involved, regardless of their level of culpability. He doesn't give up on any one of them, and the point is, he won't give up on us either. Consider Sarah. The opening sentence shows God's faithfulness, doesn't it? Now, the Lord was gracious to Sarah. The Lord was gracious to Sarah. Sarah's desire for a child was very personal, to the best I can understand. I don't think her motive was to get Abraham that great nation that God promised. She just wanted a baby. And God was gracious to her. He gave her her heart's desire. Did she deserve that blessing? Was she a model of faith? Did she treat Abraham with respect? Was she kind to Hagar and Ishmael? Far from it. Yet God still loved her. And in this case, God still blessed her. So why does God bless you and me? Why does he show kindness to us day in and day out? Is it because we're faithful to him? No, it's because he is faithful to us. I just read in Lamentations 3, it's because of the Lord's great love we're not consumed, for his compassions never fail, they're new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. All right, that's Sarah. What about Abraham? We're going to see that God was faithful to him as well. Abraham was in that impossible situation. He did not know which way to turn, and God in his faithfulness intervened. God could have simply remained silent. Say, you made your bed, you lie in it, buddy. You're on your own. But instead, he came by his side and said, we're going to get through this together, you and me. And he gave him the direction that he needed. He said, listen to Sarah, send Hagar away. That passage is encouraging. Even if we're responsible for the mess we're in, God helps us in our time of need. He remains faithful. All right, he's faithful to Sarah, faithful to Abraham, and we read that he is remarkably faithful to Hagar and Ishmael. In their case, I think God goes above and beyond. Oh my goodness, he treats them with some remarkable tenderness. Ishmael, you remember, is literally dying, and the thirst has left him in dire straits. He's dying a slow death. Hagar can't bear to watch. She walks away and leaves him. God could have simply let them go. After all, Ishmael, in some sense, wasn't even supposed to be alive in the first place. He was the product of the unbelief of Sarah and Abraham. Hagar, in Sarah's estimation, was, quote, just the Egyptian slave girl. And add to that, that these two are not really part of the covenant made to Abraham and his lineage. They were, in a sense, peripheral characters to the story of the Bible. Yet God is faithful to them as well. I'm intrigued by the extent of his faithfulness. Verse 17 is nothing short of beautiful. It says, God heard the boy crying. God heard the boy crying. I heard a boy crying the other day at Joe's Pizza. He was crying and making all kinds of racket, and I was annoyed. It's like, shut that kid up. I'm trying to eat. But obviously, that's not the way God hears a boy crying. He heard Ishmael with compassion, more like a mother hears her child whimper at night. Does he need something? Is his diaper wet? Is he going to settle down? That's how God hears us when we cry. But not only did God hear him, we read what else he did. It's just one thing after the next. It said he heard him. Then an angel, he got an angel involved, called out to Sarah. Angel interact. He said, lift up the boy, take him by the hand. I will make him into a great nation. God restored or reviewed the promise he'd made to Ishmael. It's not done. It said God opened their eyes and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin of water and gave the boy a drink. An angel, a renewed promise, a well of water. And then to top it off, it says God stayed close to the boy, not just then, but as the years rolled on. We read that God was with the boy as he grew. That's no small blessing. The point is, our God's a faithful God. He will never leave us or forsake us. We must not think for a moment that we're ever alone to face the messiness of life, even if we're to blame, because God remains faithful to his people. But not only can we expect God to remain faithful to his people, we see in this passage that God remains faithful to his promise as well. He fulfills the specific promises he made to Abraham, and he will to the nation of Israel. And he will be faithful to the broader promises contained within that promise of the ultimate rule of Christ on earth. One day, the glory of God will fill the earth. When I planted my little trees in my yard, as the years rolled on, I could see them growing. Okay, they got taller, trunks got wider, branches spread out. It was no mystery involved. Their growth was measurable. I could see it with my own eyes. My promise of a beautiful yard was incrementally, observably progressing. But the promise of God for that far better world is completely different matter altogether. We can't see God's promise growing. We can't measure in any way what's happening. In fact, from what we can observe about the trajectory of planet Earth and mankind, we might conclude things aren't moving that direction at all. In fact, it looks like things are getting much worse. So on what basis can we say with confidence that God will be faithful to his promise? How can we be sure that one day we will experience that world that we all long for? The answer, little baby Isaac. Little baby Isaac. The birth of Isaac to that little family is tangible, measurable support for the ultimate fulfillment of God's promise to mankind. This story shows us the faithful character of God. What he says, he will do. And even when all the evidence that we see points the opposite direction, God comes through because God keeps his word. He did it for Abraham and Sarah, and he will do it for us. 1 year before our passage, 1 year before Isaac was born, the Lord said to Sarah, "This time next year, you will hold a baby." Her response? Laughter. The promise of pregnancy was so preposterous, she found it comical. No way. You have got to be kidding me. And she laughed. In chapter 18, it says, and I quote, Sarah was very old. It also says Sarah was well advanced in years. And in case there was any doubt, Sarah herself logged in and says, I'm worn out. Sarah was clearly, as the Bible said, past the age of childbearing. This week, my dad called me on the phone to tell me that mom spent a night in the hospital. He said, it's okay. He said, I'm going to go pick her up now. Everything's fine. I'm going to bring her home. Whenever my dad calls, I'm never quite sure what he's going to say about mom. But I am sure of this. He's never going to call me and say, hey, Steve, mom's pregnant. Pregnancy for Sarah was not unlikely. It's impossible. All the evidence is stacked against her. She's 90. Abraham's 100. They've been trying and longing for children for decades to no avail. Not a single shred of hope that Sarah will have a baby except one. The faithfulness of God. What he says, he will do. We read in verse 1 that the Lord was gracious to Sarah as he had said. And the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant, bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the very time God had promised. And it goes on and says they named him Isaac, which means laughter. Laughter. When God made that promise in chapter 18, she laughed in unbelief. No way. But here, when she laughed, she's laughing in astonishment. I can't believe you did it. You did it. We read in verse 6, she says, Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. I wouldn't be surprised. Fast forward. That when you and I experience for the first time the wonders of the new heaven and the new earth. When we see someone who's been in a wheelchair for years get out and walk and jump. When we're reunited with loved ones we have died decades before. When we feel for the first time relief from our own sinful hearts. And when we take in beauty and sights and sounds that we can barely imagine. I wouldn't be surprised one bit if at that point we broke out in the greatest laughs of our entire lives. Just said, he did it. He did it just as he said. Until the Lord returns, guys, it's going to be a bumpy ride. It will likely be bumpy for many of us this week to come. In fact, it's likely pretty rough for some of you this very moment. During these times, we can all be encouraged with this. Despite the messiness of life, even if it's caused by our own sin, God remains faithful. He won't abandon us. He will see us through. The Apostle Paul captures this thought in Philippians 1, where he says, he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. How far? Until the day of Christ Jesus. My friends, we'll get there. We're going to make it. Glory to God for his faithfulness.